The following message was delivered on Sunday morning, April 1st, 2001, in the Adult Sunday School class at the Trinity Baptist Church in Montville, New Jersey.
Now, as has already been announced, this morning we will begin to work our way through a survey of the Old Testament. It will take us several Lord's days, as you would suspect, but we will begin this morning. Now, this will not be an Old Testament introduction class in which we will get into the details of the date of the various books, the debates concerning the authorship of the various books. We will not get into great detail concerning the historical background of the books, even though we will briefly touch upon all of those items from time to time during the class. This will also not be an attempt to work our way through a detailed exposition of the various books of the Old Testament. This is an Old Testament survey, and the key word there is survey. We will be seeking to get a broad overview of what is contained in the 39 books of the Old Testament in order to help us to get a better handle on those books and how they fit into the overall teaching of the Old Testament. We will include a little bit of historical background from time to time, some geographical information that hopefully will be helpful from time to time. We will also, out of necessity, need to touch upon authorship, for that will help us better understand what is contained in the books. But those are all asides to the primary purpose of getting a handle on the overall teaching of what is found in the books of the Old Testament. Now, there are a couple of ways that we can approach this survey. We can approach it, first of all, from a topical perspective, that is, the perspective found in our Bibles. In the English Bible, the Old Testament books are arranged in a topical manner. They are arranged under three headings. First of all, we find the law. That is, the first five books of the Old Testament, those books written by Moses. The second category in our English Bibles is the writings, the historical books of Joshua through Esther, and then the poetical and wisdom books of Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon. Those two together, the historical books and the poetical books, make up the second category in our English Bibles, as far as the Old Testament is concerned, that category called the writings. The third category in our English Bibles is the prophets, the major or longer prophetical works of Isaiah, Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel, and Daniel. And then finally, the 12 minor or shorter prophetical works, Hosea through Malachi. So one way to approach this study of Old Testament survey is to survey the books in the topical order in which they are found in our English Bibles. The Hebrew Bible is also arranged in a topical manner, but in an order which is somewhat different from our English Bibles. Again, there are three categories of books in the Hebrew Old Testament. First of all, the Torah, or the Law. Again, the first five books of the Old Testament, those books written by Moses. The second category in the Hebrew Old Testament is the prophets. What the Hebrew Old Testament calls the Navi'im, from the Hebrew word Navi, which is to prophesy. But in the Hebrew Bible, this second grouping is made up of Joshua. Now, this is the prophets. Joshua, Judges, Samuel, 1st and 2nd Samuel together, Kings, 1st and 2nd Kings together, then Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and finally the 12 prophets, which we call the minor prophets, in the same order that they are found in our English Bibles. That's the second category, the prophets. And then the third category in the Hebrew Bible is the writings, the Ketuvim. which comes from the word which means to write. And included in this category, in this order, Psalms, Job, Proverbs, Ruth, Song of Solomon, Ecclesiastes, Lamentations, Esther, Daniel, and finally Chronicles, that is 1st and 2nd Chronicles, together. So the order of the books in the Hebrew Old Testament is somewhat different from the order in our English Bibles. In their English Bible, we have, first of all, the law, then the writings, and finally the prophets. Where in the Hebrew Bible, you have the law, then the writings, and or then the prophets, and finally the writings. And it is interesting that these are the standard divisions into which the Old Testament was divided shortly after the Old Testament was completed. And to see this demonstrated from the Bible itself, I would ask you to turn with me to Luke chapter 24. Luke chapter 24. Now notice what Jesus says in verse 44. Luke 24 and verse 44. And he said unto them, speaking to his disciples after his resurrection, and he said unto them, these are my words which I spake unto you while I was yet with you, that all things must needs be fulfilled which are written in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms concerning me. So here Jesus is speaking of himself and his work being foretold in the Old Testament scriptures. And notice how he identifies the Old Testament scriptures, the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms, which is another designation for this third category, since it is either first or early on in this third category, a major collection in the third category known as the writings. So even in the first century, the whole of the Old Testament was organized under these three categories. Now, we could survey the books of the Old Testament in the topical order that is found in the Hebrew Bible, but that would most likely complicate our study more than it will be complicated already. So if we're going to follow a topical order, we will most likely follow that order found in our English Bibles. But now there is a second way that we can approach our study of Old Testament survey, and that is to survey the books of the Old Testament in a chronological order. By that I do not mean the order in which they were written, but chronological according to the time frame of the material contained in the books themselves. Now the trouble with taking this approach is that some of the books have little or no temporal elements, that is, little or no elements having to do with time in them. For example, it would be difficult to know exactly where to place the Psalms, since the Psalms were written over a relatively long period of time, beginning all the way back with Moses. The book of Proverbs has no temporal context other than the fact that the Proverbs, for the most part, were written by Solomon. The same could be said for the book of Ecclesiastes. So there are some difficulties in surveying the Old Testament in a strictly chronological manner. Well, that being the case, in our survey of the Old Testament, we will seek to combine these two approaches. Whenever possible, we will survey these 39 books of the Old Testament in a chronological manner. When that is not possible, we will of necessity have to look at them topically. Now this morning we will begin by looking at that book of the Old Testament which everyone agrees is the first in chronological order, the book of Genesis. Now in the Hebrew Old Testament, the individual books are given the title of the first significant Hebrew word found in the book itself. So if you went to a Hebrew Old Testament and you could read what was at the top of the page, you would not find any, I won't say any, you would not find most of the titles that we find in our English Bibles. For in the Hebrew Bible, the individual books are given the title of the first significant word in that book. The book of Genesis begins with the words Bareshit bara Elohim. In the beginning, God created. The first word is Bareshit, in the beginning. So if you turn to the first page of a Hebrew Bible, the title of the first book would be Bareshit. And the Greek translation of the Old Testament, known as the Septuagint, the title is Genesis, which comes from the Greek word genao, which means to begin. And that word Genesis then is brought down into our English Bibles as Genesis. So clearly that book whose first word is in the beginning is indeed the first Old Testament book in chronological order, for you cannot go further back than in the beginning. Now the author of the book of Genesis and the other four of the first five books of the Old Testament is Moses. Now, that is clear from the testimony of the Old Testament as well as the testimony of the Lord Jesus himself. Now, the only part of the Pentateuch, that is the first five books of the Old Testament which was not written by Moses, is that account of the death of Moses in the last few verses of the book of Deuteronomy, an account which must have been added by an inspired editor of some sort. Now, in order to understand the book of Genesis, we must remember the context in which Moses wrote it. The book of Genesis is part of a larger document, is part of what has come to be known as the Pentateuch, penta meaning five, the first five books of Moses, books which were written by Moses for a specific purpose and according to a specific plan. At the time that Moses writes the Genesis account, Israel has just been redeemed from bondage in Egypt and has just entered into a covenant with Jehovah at Mount Sinai. And Moses writes the book of Genesis in order to recount the history of God's people prior to the Exodus. As we shall see, beginning at creation, Moses traces the origin of God's people through their successive generations. He shows their place in relation to the nations around them. He recalls the history of God's redemptive activity in the world in general and in Israel and Israel's ancestors in particular. And by the guidance of the Spirit of God, Moses records the specific details which are included in the book of Genesis in order to instruct this emerging nation of Israel, in order to teach them what they need to know in order to walk in this covenant relationship with God in a way that is pleasing to God. That's why he's writing these things. We are simply reading something that he has written for another primary purpose. Not that the God who inspired it all did not have us in mind, but secondarily we are in mind. Primarily, it was written in order to instruct the children of Israel as they have now entered into a covenant relationship with God. Remember, the children of Israel have been in bondage for 400 years. The last real hero of the faith was Joseph, and he has been dead for many generations. The children of Israel have been constantly exposed to the impure polytheistic, that is, many gods religion of the Egyptians. And as we shall see when we come to the book of Exodus, they have embraced much of the idolatry and the immorality of the Egyptians and have brought it out of Egypt with them. Except for what has been passed down by word of mouth during these 400 years, the children of Israel have very little understanding of who Jehovah is. Remember, there were no written scriptures at this point in time. Israel has been under foreign control for almost twice as long as our country has been in existence. For generations, they have had no word from God and no spiritual leaders. Now, they're not in total darkness, but the light that they have is very, very dim at this point in their history. After his 40 years in the wilderness, Moses returns to Egypt and says to the Israelites, Jehovah has sent me. Now Jehovah has delivered them from Egyptian bondage and is taking them to the promised land. But the Israelites really don't know who Jehovah is. That's why they're so surprised when he comes and says, Jehovah has sent me. Who? And why has he sent you to us? Is he just another national or tribal god like the gods of the Egyptians or the gods of the Canaanites? Who is he? Why should we serve him? And why is this covenant with him such a big deal? So for the purpose of informing and instructing the children of Israel about who Jehovah is, who they are in respect to Jehovah, instructing them about the relationship of Jehovah to their forefathers and what promises were made to them, which now affect this generation, who they are with respect to the surrounding nations, for the purpose of instructing the children of Israel concerning these and other matters, God leads Moses to pen the words of the book of Genesis. So basically, the book of Genesis was written to bring the descendants of Jacob up to date after their 400 years in pagan Egypt. Now this morning we will spend the remainder of our time seeking to survey what God led Moses to record here in this first book of the Bible, the book of beginnings. Now the content of the book of Genesis, this book of beginnings, can be organized under two simple headings. I would have noted these on the board had I been here on time. I apologize for that. But the first heading, beginning in verse 1 of Genesis 1, and going through verse 32 of Genesis 11, is the beginning of the universe, of the earth, and of man. The beginning of the universe, the earth, and of man. But then beginning in verse 1 of chapter 12 and going all the way through the end of the book of Genesis, the beginning of God's covenant people. So two headings, two very simple headings. The beginning of the universe, the earth, and man. So there is a general discussion of where everyone has come from. And then now focusing down upon a specific group, the beginning of God's covenant people. So those are the two major headings. So through Moses, here in the book of Genesis, God is informing the children of Israel how they came to be where they presently are. They have just been miraculously delivered from the Egyptians. They are wandering around in the wilderness of Sinai. This God whose name is Jehovah has made a covenant with them. He is promising to be their God and that they can be his people. He is promising to take them into a land flowing with milk and honey. And here in this book of Genesis, through Moses, God reveals to them how all of this has come about. For remember, they're in darkness for 400 years and they don't have a clue. He begins by telling them in the first two chapters of Genesis, especially in the first chapter, he begins by telling them that all that there is, that is, all that there is except God himself, has been created by their God. Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And from here, he goes on to describe the 6 days of creation and what God created during those 6 days. And the point for the children of Israel is that their God, that Jehovah, is not like the gods of the Egyptians. Now remember, their concept of deity is going to have been very much formed by what they have heard during these 400 years. Very little has been passed down by word of mouth, and the further away they have come from Joseph, very much less has been passed down. So their concept of deity is very much the polytheistic concept of the Egyptians where there are all kinds of gods. And Moses is communicating to them that it is that their God is not like that. He is not like the gods of the Egyptians. Their God, this God who has delivered them from Egypt, this God who has entered into covenant with them, this God who is making to them these great promises, this God is able to keep these promises because unlike the Egyptian gods, he is the creator of all things. The religious perspectives which they had picked up from their 400 years in Egypt were faulty. The universe was not and is not eternal. The universe did not come as a simple result of the working of natural forces. It was not produced because there were a group of gods fussing and fighting over things, and somehow it was accidentally created as they were feuding among themselves. The universe did not come as simply the working of natural forces. It had a beginning. And the beginning, says Moses, is that it was your God who created it. This God that I have come to represent created all that you see, created everything except himself. There are not a multitude of gods as the Egyptians believe, each one ruling over a particular geographical location or each one being a specialist over certain areas of your life, one being the god of the crops and the other being the god of the weather. There is one God, that one God who created and who rules all things, and that God is Jehovah, your God, says Moses to the Israelites. Then moving on from the creation of the universe and the earth, the children of Israel are informed concerning the creation of man himself. Beginning in verse 26 of Genesis 1, Moses records this. And God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heaven, and over the cattle, and over all the earth." And then he goes on to describe the creation of Adam and then of Eve. He identifies the Garden of Eden as that location where God has placed, or where God placed Adam and Eve. And from the identification of the garden as being at the headwaters of four different rivers, the Pishon, the Gihon, the Hiddekel, which we know from the book of Daniel is the river Tigris, and fourthly, the Euphrates. From that information, even though most likely when the flood came, most of those river courses were dramatically changed, from that description, it appears that the Garden of Eden was somewhere in northern Mesopotamia, up in this area. This is the Arabian Desert. Israel is here. Sinai, Egypt, Mesopotamia is in this area. It appears that the Garden of Eden, because of that description of those four rivers, was someplace in that area. But the point of this portion of the record is not to help us to find the exact location of the Garden of Eden. The point of this portion is to inform the children of Israel of the place of man in the created order. Man was created in a way that was different from the animals. Man was created in the image of God. Man was created to have dominion over the earth. The woman was created to be the helper of the man in the fulfilling of this task. And the man and the woman were responsible and accountable to God. Even though they were created in the image of God, they were still God's creatures. They were to obey God. And as a test of their determination to live in obedience to their Creator, in this passage, God reveals the commandment He gave to them. That commandment concerning the eating of the tree in the midst of the garden and the death penalty that would come if they disobeyed Him. So here in the first two chapters of Genesis, the children of Israel are instructed concerning who their God is and who they are. Their God is not just some insignificant local deity that can be ignored. Their God is the God who created all things. And as for them, they are part of the human race, which has been created by God in the image of God. And this truth should help them to see the foolishness of the religions of the Egyptians and the Canaanites and all of those around about them. Man was created to have dominion over other created things. Yet the Egyptians and the other nations surrounding them were worshiping created things. They were bowing down to Ra, the sun god. They were bowing down to Hector, the frog god. They were worshiping their fellow creature in the person of Pharaoh. These forms of worship are and were inconsistent with man's place in the created order. Worship should be given to a superior being. The Egyptians were worshiping things equal to or of lesser dignity than themselves. So in these first two chapters of Genesis, it is clear only Jehovah is worthy to be worshipped. So you see, Moses, by inspiration of the Spirit, is preparing the children of Israel to worship the God that they have now entered into covenant relationship with, seeking to untrain their thinking in the ways of the Egyptian religion and to cause them to understand who the true God was and who they were. Now, what has happened? What has happened that man, who was created in the image of God, is now, according to what they can see, is now practicing such ungodlike behavior? That's a question they're going to have. If God created man, if God created everything and He created man in His image, then why is it that everyone around us, including ourselves, are doing such ungodlike things? What has happened to the most superior of God's creatures? Well, that's the next thing that Moses records here in the Genesis record. Beginning in verse 31, we find the account beginning in Genesis 3 and verse 1, we find the account of man's fall into sin. And we all know the account of the devil in the form of a serpent tempting Eve, her disobeying God in the eating of the forbidden fruit, her giving that fruit to Adam, and his sinning in the same manner. Moses records how Adam and Eve tried to hide their sin, tried to hide themselves from God. He tells us of the man seeking to shift the blame upon his wife and of the woman seeking to shift the blame upon the devil. He goes on to speak of the curses that God placed upon the woman, upon the man, upon the serpent. He tells them how Adam and Eve, their first parents, were put out of the garden. In Genesis 4, we find an account of man's now sinful nature being transmitted to the children of Adam and Eve, and how Cain killed his brother Abel, and how God responded to that by punishing Cain. Right in the midst of this most grievous event of the fall of man into sin and its immediate consequences, we find what appears to be the first glimpse of gospel light, what has been labeled by some as the proto-evangelion, that is, the first gospel, the gospel prototype, the first glimpse of the good news that God will provide a remedy for this desperate situation. Look at what God says to the serpent, beginning in verse 14 of Genesis 3. And Jehovah God said unto the serpent, because you have done this, cursed are you above all cattle and above every beast of the field. Upon your belly shall you go, and dust shall you eat all the days of your life. And I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. Even though at this early point in redemptive history, the details are not very clear, One thing which is clear is that one will come who is of the seed of the woman, to whom the evil one will do some minor damage, but who will himself deal a death blow to the evil one. Here is the first gospel promise in the Bible. And for the most part, the remainder of the Bible is the working out of this seed promise. Sin has entered into God's creation, but almost immediately God reveals that He has made provision for that sin and its instigator to be dealt with. Now, as the Genesis record continues, man, having fallen into sin, having fallen into rebellion against his Creator, what we see the beginnings of in the immediate descendants of Adam and Eve after several generations, those generations noted in Genesis 5, after several generations progresses to the point that God must take drastic measures to arrest it. Look at what is recorded in verse 5 of chapter 6. And Jehovah saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And it repented Jehovah that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him at his heart. And Jehovah said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the ground, both man and beast and creeping things and birds of the heavens, for it repents me that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of Jehovah. And from Genesis 6:1 to Genesis 9:29, we find the account of the worldwide flood which God sent as a result of the extreme wickedness of man. A flood which killed every living creature except Noah and his wife, his three sons and their wives, and the animals which God had commanded him to take into the ark. In Genesis 9, after the flood is over, God makes a covenant with Noah that he will never destroy the earth again by a flood. The token or the sign of that Noahic covenant is the rainbow, which we still see to this day. By this point in the Genesis record, the children of Israel should be getting the idea that God does not tolerate man's rebellion. They should be getting that point, for that's the point that's being made here. He's not telling them about the flood simply to give them a good story to tell to their children at bedtime. Is the point to this, and the point is God does not tolerate rebellion. The children of Israel are now in the wilderness, and they have just been or will soon be given the Ten Commandments. What will happen if they refuse to obey those commandments of God? Well, the record of the flood should make the answer to that very clear. For this is the same God, says Moses, who brought the flood. Now in Genesis 10, we find a record of the descendants of Noah after the flood and where they finally settled. In Genesis 11, we learned why they were dispensed to those locations. Back in verse 1 of chapter 9, after the flood, God commanded Noah and his sons to be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. But we read in Genesis 11 in verse 4, and they said, come, let us build us a city and a tower whose top may reach into heaven, and let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. So what God had commanded to be done in replenishing the earth, Noah's descendants had determined not to do. Apparently, they had not wandered very far away from the landing place of the ark. It was clear that they were not taking God's command to replenish the earth seriously. They had built a city. They had built a tower, apparently for some kind of worship. They were all speaking the same language, and they were settled in very comfortably. At that point, God confounds their language so that they cannot understand each other. They are forced to gather with those who have been given a similar language as their own and settle in separate locations in communities of common language. And in this manner, the various nations of the earth were formed. Not only does this explain to the children of Israel where all their neighbors came from, it also is another very clear lesson that God does not tolerate rebellion. He had given them a command. They had ignored it. God dealt with it. Now, up to this point in the Genesis record, Moses has recorded God's dealings with mankind in general, His creation of all men, the fall of all men into sin, the judgment of a worldwide flood, the dispersion of the nations. He had given them general information upon all men. But now, beginning in verse 1 of chapter 12, the focus of the record is narrowed down from all men in general to God's covenant people in particular. Why were the children of Israel singled out by God for this special covenant relationship? You know, that must have been a question in many of their minds. Why did He deliver us? We don't know much about Him, but here's the question. Why did He deliver us? And why has He promised us the land of Canaan? Why is this happening to us? Why were the children of Israel singled out by God for this special covenant relationship? It is this question which Moses focuses upon for the remainder of the book of Genesis. And the first man of which Moses speaks in this more limited context is Abram, whose name is later changed to Abraham. In Genesis 12, God calls Abraham out of Ur of the Chaldees. Ur of the Chaldees is down by the Persian Gulf, down in this area, in the area of modern-day Iran, down by the Persian Gulf. God calls Abraham out of Ur of the Chaldees and leads him to the land of Canaan. He travels from Ur of the Chaldees up toward Haran and then down into Canaan. The reason for that is because all of this is desert and all travel during that period of time, and even today if it is done on foot, is through the, what is called the Fertile Crescent, because there's where the water and the food is, and there's where there is safety in travel. So He leads Abram from Ur of the Chaldees into the land of Canaan. Notice a beginning in verse 1 of Genesis chapter 12. Genesis 12 and verse 1. Now Jehovah said unto Abram, Get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, unto the land that I will show thee, and I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee and make thy name great, and be thou a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, and him that curses thee will I curse, and in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. So Abram went, as Jehovah had spoken unto him, and Lot went with him, and Abram was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran. So he has moved now from Ur up to Haran. He's 75 years old. His father Terah dies in Haran. Verse 5, And Abraham took Sarah his wife and Lot his brother's son and all their substance that they had gathered and the souls that they had gotten in Haran. And they went forth to go into the land of Canaan. Into the land of Canaan they came. And Abram passed through the land unto the place of Shechem, under the oak of Moreh. And the Canaanite was then in the land. And the Lord appeared unto Abram and said, Unto thy seed will I give this land. And there built he an altar unto Jehovah who appeared unto him. So Abram then travels to the land of Canaan. He settles in a place called Shechem. So he comes down into the land of Canaan and settles in a place called Shechem, midway between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea, up in the hill country among the Canaanites. He moves from there, as the record tells us, a little further south, down to a place between Bethel and Ai, which is in this location just near Jerusalem at the northern tip of the Dead Sea. From there, there is famine in the land. He goes down into Egypt, which is this way. He is in Egypt for a while. He returns back to that place between Bethel and Ai where he has built an altar. It is there, remember, that there is controversy between the herdsmen of Lot and the herdsmen of Abraham, for apparently they have large flocks and a particular grazing place is not sufficient for all of those flocks. So there is controversy over the water, over the grazing lands. They separate, with Lot moving down from this location between Bethel and Ai down to the area of Sodom here at the southern tip of the Dead Sea. We know the account of what happens to Lot. We will not go into that. But soon after that, if you will notice in Genesis 13, verses 14 through 17, God again makes a promise to Abraham. Genesis 13 and verse 14. And the Lord said unto Abram, after that Lot was separated from him, lift up now thine eyes and look from the place where you are, northward and southward, eastward and westward. For all the land which you see, to thee will I give it, and to your seed forever. And I will make your seed as the dust of the earth, so that if a man can number the dust of the earth, then may thy seed also be numbered. Arise, walk throughout the land, in the length of it, and in the breadth of it, and unto thee will I give it. And Abram moved his tent, and came and dwelt by the oaks of Mamre, which were in Hebron, and built there an altar unto the Lord. So it is between Bethel and Ai in this location that there's a controversy with Lot. God then communicates to him that he will give him this land, and Abram then moves down to Hebron, which is here. And we know again the account of Sodom being destroyed. Lot is in Hebron. Remember, the angel of the Lord comes and speaks to Lot, and they walk out toward Sodom, toward the high country across, looking out across the Dead Sea. He sees the smoke later on of Sodom and the cities of the plain arising. Lot has been delivered, and it is also during that same period of time that another promise is made concerning a seed. He has promised him children as numerable as the sands of the seashore. And remember, Abraham is quite old at that point. And there is a point in time where his faith is weak. And he takes Hagar, his wife's maidservant. Ishmael is born rather than waiting upon the promised seed. And we all know the ramifications of that after Isaac is finally born according to promise. Ishmael and his mother are asked to leave, and they travel down toward the Negev, down toward the south, and settle here with conflict still going on to this day over that issue. Abraham later on moves even further south, down to Beersheba, which is down in this area. And so Abraham, settling in the land of Canaan, settles along this mountain spine of four places: Shechem, Bethel, Hebron, and Beersheba. So he settles in the mountains, which eventually is where Israel will settle. It is there in Beersheba that Sarah dies and is buried. It is there in Beersheba that God calls upon Abraham to sacrifice Isaac, his only son. So he takes Isaac from Beersheba up to the area of Jerusalem, to Mount Moriah, and attempts to sacrifice him in obedience to God. And, of course, we know the story of God stopping that sacrifice, knowing that Abram is willing to be obedient to him. Again, lessons to the children of Israel. In spite of how things look, obey God, and things will work out well. They're in a situation where things do not look so good. I've been in the Sinai Desert. I wouldn't want to live there either. But in spite of how things looked, Abram was prepared to do what God said, and God blessed him. So these are lessons that they need to learn from their own history. The next main character in the book of Genesis is Abraham's son, Isaac. There's very little information given about Isaac. It's interesting that there's only a chapter and a half about Isaac in the book of Genesis. There is 14 chapters about Abraham. There's 11 chapters about Jacob. There's 14 chapters about Joseph and a chapter and a half about Isaac. So we know very little about him. We know that he did live down in Beersheba in the southern part of Israel. We do know that a wife was sent for by Abram, and Rebekah was found up in Haran and brought back by Abraham's servant to Isaac down in Beersheba. We do know that Isaac and Rebekah had twins, Esau and Jacob. And we do know, if you will turn with me to chapter 26, that the covenant made with his father Abraham was reiterated, was ratified with Isaac. Chapter 26, beginning in verse 1. And there was a famine in the land, besides the first famine that was in the days of Abraham. And Isaac went unto Abimelech, a king of the Philistines, unto Gerar. And Jehovah appeared unto him and said, Do not go down into Egypt. Dwell in the land which I shall tell thee of. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and will bless you. For unto you and unto your seed I will give all these lands, and I will establish the oath which I swear unto Abraham your father. And I will multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens, and I will give unto your seed all these lands, and in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. Notice very similar language to what was said to his father Abraham. So this covenant relationship with Abraham has now been passed on down through his son Isaac. The next main character is Jacob. We know the story of how the blessing of the firstborn was promised to Jacob even before he was born, and how Esau sold his birthright for a bowl of soup. We also know how his mother Rebekah sought to deceive his father Isaac and to give him the blessing. Remember the skin with the hair put upon Jacob's arm so that the half-blind father would think it was Esau. So she was not prepared to wait upon God's timing. She tried to instigate this deception. Then after Esau is troubled with what Jacob has done, it is clear that he is out to get him. So Rebekah goes in to convince her husband Isaac that Jacob really needs to go up to their relatives back up in Haran to find a wife. Actually, she's just trying to get him out of town before his brother kills him. And so Jacob, as you remember, flees up to Haran. So he is now traveling all the way from this area of Beersheba, way back up to Haran, and he comes to a place where his grandfather had settled for a period of time in Bethel. And it is there that he falls asleep. It is there that he has a dream of a ladder extending to heaven. He calls the place the house of God, which is what Beth-El means in Hebrew. From there he travels on up to Haran, and within a period of 20 years, he departs with four wives and 12 children, daughters, for the most part, of his uncle Laban. He returns to Canaan, back from Haran, which is up in this area. He returns to Canaan back in this direction. By that time, Esau has moved from Beersheba over to what is called Mount Seir, which is over on the other side of the Dead Sea in Edom. He sends word down to Esau that he is coming home. And Esau comes north to meet him. He promises Esau, I will follow you back home. At this point, he is in this area. He has has camped and has been waiting on Esau. Remember, it is at that point that he wrestles with the angel of God. His name is changed from Jacob to Israel. Esau comes up from Mount Seir to meet him. They embrace. He promises him, you go ahead. I have women and some young children here. We'll be a little slower. We will follow you home. Esau's over the hill. He turns west and goes into the land of Canaan. Another deception on his part. He settles in the same cities. If you read the account, he settles in the same cities, in Shechem, in Bethel, in Hebron, in Beersheba, in the same cities that his father Abraham settled in. Finally, 25 years later, his grandfather Abraham, 25 years later, his father Isaac dies, and at that point, Esau and Jacob get together one more time to bury their father. Other than that, their relationship was practically non-existent because of what had happened some 45 years before. Again, the covenant was ratified with Jacob. The covenant that had been made with Abraham had been passed down to Isaac, and then through Jacob, whose name has now been changed to Israel. The final character in the book of Genesis is Joseph. Most of us know the account of Joseph. They are living in Hebron. Joseph is one of the sons of Israel, one of the sons of Jacob. They're living in Hebron. They have sheep that are being herded by his brothers up in Shechem, all the way up here. He has been telling about this dream that he has had, about how all his brothers are going to bow down to him. He has been given by his father this coat of many colors. His brothers are jealous. He goes from Hebron up to Shechem to check on his brothers and the sheep. They are not there. They are over in a place called Dothan, which is over in this area. Remember, they capture him. They debate about whether to kill him or not. He is cast into a pit. And there are a group of Midianite traders traveling through this main highway down into Egypt. Interestingly, we will get into that a little while later. Well, I'll just not touch upon it now. There's no point in it. But he is sold to these Midianite traders for 20 pieces of silver. He is taken down into Egypt, where he is sold to Potiphar, a captain in Pharaoh's guard. We all know the account of the difficulties that he had with Potiphar's wife, finally cast into prison. In that prison, he is given the interpretation of several dreams. Word of that gets out to the powers that be, and eventually he interprets Pharaoh's dreams and is made a ruler in Egypt, second in command. It is not too long after that that there is famine in the land of Canaan. Jacob and his other children and their wives and their children are not doing very well. They are in need of food. So Jacob sends his family down to Egypt because he hears that there's plenty of food in Egypt. And they, of course, meet their brother Joseph, come home and tell their father, who then in turn moves the family to Egypt because his son is the vice president. Jacob then, as he is about to die, blesses his sons and makes it very evident during that blessing that Messiah is to come from the tribe of Judah, that the scepter is to pass to the tribe of Judah. Another unfolding of this promise made in Genesis 3:15. This seed of the woman is going to be now, we are told, from the tribe of Judah. And Jacob dies there in Egypt, after being in Egypt 17 years. And then soon after that, soon after that, Joseph dies. He makes his family promise him that they will carry his bones back to Canaan when God brings the children of Israel back to Canaan. Now, how did he know they were going to come back? Because the promise had been made to Abraham, ratified to Isaac and to Jacob, that the land that they were living in, the land of Canaan, would be their land. And Joseph believed that. And his dying wish was, do not bury me in Egypt, but take my bones back to Canaan, because you will be going back. And of course, remember, who is being told this account? The children of Israel, who are indeed going back and can walk some distance and see the sarcophagus with the bones of Joseph in it. So he makes them promise to take him back in Genesis chapter 50. Notice beginning in verse 22. Genesis 50 and verse 22. And Joseph dwelt in Egypt, he and his father's house, and Joseph lived 110 years. So he lived almost 100 years in Egypt. He was 17 when he came there. And Joseph saw Ephraim's children of the third generation, that is his grandchildren. The children also of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were born upon Joseph's knees. And Joseph said unto his brethren, I am dying, but God will surely visit you and bring you up out of this land unto the land which he sware unto Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And Joseph took an oath of the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here. So Joseph died, being 110 years old. They embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. So what is happening here in the book of Genesis is that the children of Israel who are presently in the desert are being brought up to date on how they came to Egypt in the first place and why it is that they are leaving Egypt and where it is that they are going. God had singled out their forefathers for this particular blessing, making a covenant promises to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, promises which were now being fulfilled in their descendants by their being delivered from Egypt and being given the land that was promised to their ancestors. So this is not simply a book of historical facts, even though it is that. It is a book chock full of lessons about how God deals with sin, how God is faithful, what a powerful God they have and we have, and how he can supply our needs even though things look bleak around us. That's why this book was written. And if we keep that in mind, it certainly, I think, will help us to better understand it. Well, our time is gone. Let's close with prayer. Our Father, we are thankful for this record of your dealing with your people of long ago. And our Father, we know that you are the same God. And we know that the power you had at that time to fulfill your promises, you still have. And we know that your integrity is as it was then, that what you say you will do, you will indeed do. And so, our Father, we ask that you would help us as we read this material that was initially intended for the children of Israel to encourage them and to prevent them from rebelling against you. Help us to read it in that same way, realizing that you are the same God and we have the same tendencies to rebel that they did. Be merciful to us and help us. In Jesus' name, amen.